right, and welcome back, all. We have Eric Woods from Cinematic Sound Radio and Podcast Network on the show tonight. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm really excited about what we're going to be talking about tonight.
Absolutely. I'm your host, Cam, and it's been a minute. We had been planning this for a while, and then finally we were able to get it under wraps and plan a time, and we were just like, okay, sure. We got to finally discuss this beloved film composer who, I guarantee you, he's very well known, and yet not enough people talk about him still. So
very true. Very, very true.
This was very interesting because just looking up him up some more, it was actually interesting to see what had been a common misconception. For the longest time, people forget on Amazon and CD type music sites, they would often blend together the orchestrator with the composers, and that got confusing because there's a difference.
Yes, absolutely.
And I was very familiar with the movies he had scored. You know, he's done a mixture of NBC miniseries and TV movies, as well as, you know, the big budget blockbusters, as well as made for TV, direct to video, action packed or horror mystery movies. And Don Davis has been often noted. His claim to fame was doing a lot of those Joe Silver type productions and mainly the Matrix trilogy. And as a result, because his score was so John Williams-esque sounding, he ended up scoring Jurassic Park 3 and doing a damn fine imitation. His credits include the various Tiny Toon Adventures specials and spinoffs. The Wachowskis' Bound, Ronnie Yu's Warriors of Virtue, Peter Howitt's Antitrust, The Slasher Valentine, the Andy Garcia mystery film, The Unsaid, the original Behind Enemy Lines, the UK horror mystery Long Time Dead, as well as other work on the House on Haunted Hill remake, Universal Soldier 2, The Return, Turbulence 2, The Animatrix, The Marine, 10-inch Hero, the Japanese film Tokyo Ghoul, as well as the 2018 sci-fi indie Beyond the Sky. In addition to that, he also scored various other just cult movies, as well as getting acclaim for scoring miniseries and shows such as Beauty and the Beast, Tasmania, which, yes, has to do with the Tasmanian Devil, Sequest 2032, and the miniseries House of Frankenstein. He, in addition to that, he has composed, served with the orchestra, mostly for Randy Newman and James Horner and Alan Silvestri and Michael Kamen, for their various productions, including the Police Academy films, Clear and Present Danger, Apollo 13, and the Toy Story films. So just a lot to take in. But first of all, Eric, tell us a little about how you decided, hey, you know, I'm going to help. Yeah, you have a very cool podcast network. You have like 5 different shows on there, and they go into all sorts of things, including TV soundtracks and video game scores. But when did you decide, hey, you know, I'm going to take the leap. I'm going to find out what makes these various music scores tick, why they're awesome.
Yeah, I've always liked film scores in films. I mean, ever since I was a kid. I mean, the one thing that I do remember clearly is seeing Return of the Jedi for the very first time. It was my first time at a theater. It was in one of those, you know, big fancy theaters in Toronto. And, you know, that just made such an impression. And the music did as well that, you know, I went home, I had the themes in my head and I was whistling them to myself, and I love to draw. So I opened up my sketchbook and I was drawing X-Wings and TIE Fighters and whatnot. And I was singing along to with the Star Wars music. Yeah. And you know, like what kid, my imagination was just coming out on the page, but I was, you know, I had those themes and that music in my head. And then, so as I went along, I was conscious of the music, but I didn't really start taking it seriously as really looking into it until I was in high school.
Where you kind of singing it loud and then going, oh, whoa, 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 whoa.
Yeah.
Don't look at me.
Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, I was recording stuff off the television. I mean, because I didn't know that you could like buy soundtracks or scores. And I didn't have any money anyway. So I was taping things off the television and playing them back for myself. And so there was times where, you know, movies would come on and I'm like, guys, shut up. I got to record the end credits because that's usually where, you know, the music would play without any sound effects. But when I was in high school, I got to do a project on John Williams and I studied his career and music in depth. It was a huge project. We also played a ton of film music in the high school band.
Mm.
But then once I was doing that research for John Williams, I found all these soundtracks that I could listen to. And I'm like, what is this? There were all these Boston Pops recordings or
before
these
iTunes was doing Pops it.
Recordings. If you like, it was all these miscellaneous like compilations. And I'm like, wait, that's the Jaws theme. That's ET. That's Close Encounters. That's one guy. And I grew up with that. And then all of a sudden it was, oh, who's James Horner? Then I like, who's Jerry Goldsmith? And that just exploded. And I started collecting. And then it was my second year of college that I decided that, I mean, I always wanted to be on the radio. That was a dream of mine. Mm-hmm. And of course, what college, you know, doesn't have a radio station. And yeah. So I pitched,
they're not
I
doing
pitched
their my job idea. If they don't have a radio station.
Right. But I pitched my idea. The station manager at the time actually rejected my idea because he said, we already have a show tunes show. And I'm like, oh, I don't do show tunes. I'm doing film scores like Star Wars and whatnot. And he's like, oh, well, that's interesting. So here's your time slot. And I did FM radio for 10 years. And sweet. And that's where it really became a serious obsession of getting to know as much film music as I can, but also to help promote the art form because not too many people know about it. And so whatever I could do to get that out to the public and, you know, let them know that, yeah, this stuff is out there. You might not even notice it, or you might know a few themes here and there, but here's all this other great stuff that you can listen to. And we'll listen to it together for 3 hours without the sound effects, without the visuals. And we'll talk about it. And we'll you can discover it. Music that you would never have heard before on radio. Mm-hmm. So, and then it turned into the podcast. I've been doing it for 26 years and, you know, 7,000 CDs, and I still need more, and I'm still learning more. I'm still reading, you know, more information about it. So I love it. I really do love film scores.
Very nice. Yeah, no, you've done some good deep dives, and, you know, it's not, I like how you'll also, you and many of the others will also do kind of a themed. It's like, okay, we're going for a good chunk of James Horner's material. Now we're going for a bunch of these other well-known composers. Okay, now it's TV Tunes Volume 5, you know?
It's always important. I mean, on top of not only promoting it, but it's also just making sure that you're creating something entertaining. And I'm sure you understand that as well, you know, having your own podcast. So it's having some sort of structure, and I write everything I say down. I rarely ad lib. I'm terrible at that. And I mean, even for tonight, I have got 3 pages of information in front of myself just so I make sure that I get the information correct. But
yeah.
I want to produce a show that I would love to listen to. That was my goal. So I love professionally produced programs. I love good sounding programs, and I love radio shows or music shows, right, that do a lot of explaining. Like, give me a reason to listen to that piece of music. And that's what I do on my show.
Why does it gel?
Yeah, well, that's exactly it. It's like, well, here can be the asteroid field music from The Empire Strikes Back. Okay, so what is this music doing, though? Like, at this point, what's happening? At this point, what's happening? This is why the music is doing what it's doing. So I will tell them about it. And now here's the piece of music for you to enjoy with the context.
And people love it when, aside from just the detail, like you're saying, you want to actually kind of sample and then go through and decide, okay, this is a bearable score, but it's, you know, it may or may not, you know, be as great, you know, without the visual or vice versa. You never know until you know.
Yeah, indeed. And that's the I think one thing that I'm really proud of is that I'll still play stuff that I don't necessarily like, but
yeah,
I've got to do the work, and I just can't play everything that I like, because the stuff that I like is very traditional, it's very orchestral, but there's way more different subgenres of film music and things like that that are very interesting to explore, whether I like the style or not. So, I mean, I'm trying my best to be as diverse as possible, but of course there's stuff that I'll do a show that of just the stuff that I like, and it's my show, I can do that. But yeah, it's also important to, right, I'm the boss, but it's also important that, you know, with my network is that I've got a guy doing anime music and I rarely listen to that. So I learn a lot from his show, or there's somebody who's doing video game music and I love video game music, but he knows way more than I do. So I love listening to that. I've also got a trained composer who does interviews with composers, but kind of goes into the more, you know, the nuances of how to compose music. And I find that fascinating. It's not something I can do. So
have you heard of composers as well? The film score podcast.
Sorry, say that again.
Have you heard of Composers, the Film Score podcast?
Yes, I have. Yeah, yeah. They're literally an hour down the road. They're from Toronto.
It's so much fun. Oh, really?
Yeah.
They're, small world.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the thing is, I haven't been on one of their shows. And the thing is, I'm a beer connoisseur as well. So I would love to be on the, you know, just drinking and talking film scores.
Absolutely, absolutely. I take it The Matrix was the first score you heard by him?
By Don Davis? No. The thing is, again, with the nature of my show, the thing is, I knew about Don Davis, and I knew about Beauty and the Beast, long before he got into like major film work. I even remember his work on Sequest DSV, and I was also very familiar with his name, flipping through liner notes and seeing his name as the orchestrator for Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves for Michael Kamen, working extensively with James Horner. And so, but the one real score that kind of piqued my interest was his first work with the Wachowskis on Bound. And that one, was like, okay, one, the film is outstanding, but I'm hearing stuff in this score that I don't think I've ever heard before. It's mixing a whole bunch of different styles. I mean, you listen to it, The Matrix is in Bound. I mean, the pile driver sound is in Bound. And so
same kind of close-ups even for
absolutely
kind of music inserts. Yeah.
Yeah. But there's there's a lot of great jazz and there's a couple of mambos. It's an interesting modern film noir, but it's very much Don Davis, and Don Davis's sound, it is unmistakable. And you can even hear his sound in the stuff that he was orchestrating for other composers. I mean, there aren't too many composers that would write full sketches. Randy Newman was one of them. And mm-hmm. So Don Davis really didn't have to do much work, but there were other composers that would like hand a piano sketch or an idea, and they would have to write a fully realized cue. And you can hear Don Davis's influence on those scores in scores from Kamen or James Horner especially. But yeah, Bound was really the first one where I'm like, oh, that's Don Davis. And then of course Warriors of Virtue came out, and I remember seeing commercials for that. I'm like, what in the world is this movie? But I got the soundtrack and I just absolutely loved it. But when it came down to The Matrix, the funny thing about The Matrix is I didn't really know at the time what that movie was. I wasn't following it. And I didn't realize that Don Davis was attached to it. I'm not sure why. I think I was paying more attention to what was happening on Star Wars, The Phantom Menace, than I was with The Matrix. And then when I saw the film and I heard the score, and I'm like, well, this doesn't seem like the type of score that would be in a movie of this sort. Because all I was expecting was like EDM music, electronic music, which is something the Wachowskis sort of wanted, but they really wanted the orchestra. They knew that the power of the orchestra is going to drive the score. And when I heard that, in combination with these very modern visuals, I thought, wow, this is a really interesting combination that you probably wouldn't see in most films. But the Wachowskis were really proud of Don Davis's work, and they loved what he did on Bound, and bringing him over on the Matrix trilogy was just a wonderful leap of faith. And Don Davis, I think, just gave it his all and wrote an absolute classic score. And it's kind of, I'm shocked it didn't get an Academy Award nomination due to the popularity of that film and the amount of technical awards that it did get nominated for and won. The fact that this score, it broke so much ground. It did. I mean, there really hasn't been another score like it since, with the exception of a composer named Christopher Willis, who's writing very similar music for, there was a film that came out a couple of years ago called The Personal History of David Copperfield. And he was writing in that kind of avant-garde, postmodern, minimalist style with big orchestra. And that reminded me a lot of Don Davis. But you're not hearing it. Don Davis is really, this is a really rare and unique score. And it's just absolutely mind-blowing. And the entire trilogy is absolutely fantastic.
Totally. I read a cool article. It's an older one that's been reprinted from Industry Central, and he talked about how a lot of he wanted to be more heavily involved with the electronic group Juno Reactor, but he ended up just giving their music notes because they were pressed for time. And what's funny is people forget during that time, you know, Davis was very overworked. He was, you know, composing the both sequels as well as the Animatrix. And so his orchestrator Eric Lundborg, who's had a huge career his own self, had to score the video game. And I actually was able to get that soundtrack.
It's outstanding. It's outstanding. Oh, yeah. I got it. Yeah, I got a promo from the from his agent. So I was like, I'm listening to him going, wow, if there's anybody that's gonna ever take over the Matrix, here's the guy. But I mean, he worked closely with Don Davis on the Matrix. And so but it's amazing though that the between, let's say, 1998 when he began working on the Matrix, with the Matrix coming out a year later, and then into 2003 at the end there, the sheer amount of work this man did and just what he was cranking out. I mean, his 1999 alone, he was working on 4 movies. And I think that's what a lot of people forget, is that there wasn't just the Matrix. Mm-hmm. You know, it was Universal Soldier 2, House on Haunted Hill, and he had Turbulence 2, The Fear of Flying, and all very, very, very different scores.
Totally different kinds of movies. Right.
And then there's a whole bunch of other stuff in there. And of course, there's the pressure of Jurassic Park 3 as well, while he is starting up on Matrix Reloaded and the Matrix Revolutions at the exact same time. I mean, this guy was overworked. And I think that's one of the reasons why we really didn't hear much from him afterwards. And of course, he wanted to work on his opera. But I mean, it's really sad that he hasn't been utilized. And I'm not sure why he decided that he was. I don't think Don Davis is done with Hollywood, but it's like nobody is asking for him to score films. He still orchestrates for Randy Newman, but I mean, he's doing manga adaptations in Japan. He's doing documentaries, but nothing to the scale of the Matrix. And of course, the Wachowskis moved on from that entire team after Revolutions. I don't think they kept anybody except maybe one of the producers on Speed Racer.
Yeah.
And that was a shock. It was really a shock that where it was like, Don Davis isn't working on this. I mean, Giacchino wrote a great score anyway, but it was like, oh, wow, that collaboration's over. I thought that was something that was just starting. And I was really curious as to where that was going to lead to. But yeah, I don't know what, Don Davis still, I mean, he loved working on classical music before he started with film music. And so he got to do his opera, which I think he did on spec. And
I think so.
Yeah. It's huge. I've never heard it, but I would love to. But, I don't know. I really wish that people were still utilizing his voice. Cause I think he's very extremely diverse. He can do anything. He can do rock and roll, pop, he could do electronic, he could do fully orchestral, but it's sad that his voice is no longer in modern day film.
Yeah. It's one of those just unfortunate moments where, like you say, is like, why is he stuck doing kind of just casual, like, international movies that no one's really heard of, or just corporate commercials or what have you, or like you say, going back and helping out Randy Newman the last decade. And
yeah,
like you say, it every one of his scores just stands out so well. I used to have the Behind Enemy Lines score. That was where I just really dug how he incorporated electronic tunes with overall, though, I really do prefer his Unisoul 2, as well as the I listen to the Ballistic X versus Sever soundtrack quite a lot also. Totally different, but I really like how he kind of just illustrates just the grit. And for he did a banged up job for a movie that had production issues. They, you know, the producers fired the director, and then they replaced Trevor. I don't think it was Raven, but it was one of those other Trevor film composers, and they just replaced him just last minute. Like, and I think he did a banged up job making that his own, but that, like you said too, like House on Haunted Hill and even The Onset, he deals with a lot of creepy cues, and Jurassic Park 3 is just nonstop tension. I would not be surprised if, much like Graham Revell, if he reuses some of his same music notes from previous scores, especially if he took a few Matrix cues and put it in Jurassic Park 3.
Yeah, Jurassic Park 3 was a very unique situation for him, because he was handpicked by John Williams to write the music for the third film. I think he was asked by I forgot his name.
Director Joe Johnston.
Johnston. That's it.
He had worked on The Pagemaster, and I think he was impressed with how he was part of that
orchestra. I mean, Joe Johnston has never picked a bad composer to work with throughout his entire career. The fact that he had access to John Williams's scores for Jurassic Park 1 and 2, and I think he knew that that it was going to be a daunting task, but then once he started looking at those scores, he was like, oh my goodness, there's just so much intricacy in every single note, and so many different options for different harmonization, that he literally said, can I do this? I don't think I could do this. And I mean, that's hard. That's tough. And then the other thing is that he had to make adjustments to John Williams's own music and themes as well throughout that film. And that's another thing where I'm not sure how involved John Williams is with like an approval process on that, but he had to switch notes here and there, shorten like a theme and or hit a certain beat here. But that means that he had to remove a note from there. And it's like, you're playing around with classic themes here. I mean, one wrong step and you never know what's going to happen. But I think he did it amazingly. I mean, it is an enormous, fast-paced, crazy score. I can't imagine how many notes he wrote for it. But
I like how you really mentioned the notes, because at the same time, people forget it's kind of like with getting the rights to parody a song. Even, you know, you want to do a similar tone, but not just copy and paste the same, you know, score someone else wrote.
Exactly. Yeah, it stays in the realm of the John Williams traditional orchestral score.
I don't think Alan Silvestri is interested in imitating him. You know, same thing when people take over a Michael Kamen or David Arnold score, they don't want to sound too different, nor do they want to sound entirely like the previous person. They want to do their own thing and at the same time make everybody happy. It's such a hard predicament.
It's tough to get around pastiche, and I don't think Don Davis did that. I think he paid perfect homage to what John Williams was doing, utilized the existing themes that John Williams had used, but really did make it its own, but still stayed within that traditional orchestral realm that John Williams established in the first two movies. And that seems like it's a sound that Jurassic Park has been, and even into Jurassic World has been following ever since 1993.
Oh, totally. And just even seeing these additional music that he contributed to, including When a Man Loves a Woman, a Goofy Movie of all things, even doing song arrangements for James and the Giant Peach. He's like many of these composers, you're just applauding their diversity, because it just shows. It absolutely shows, instead of, well, my name's on it, but I'm really not hearing anything different. Like, I like many people, I, for instance, you know, I admire Hans Zimmer, and at the same time, he's kind of sounded the same thing for about a decade now. But that's okay. Like that, he's earned his keep. He's already done what he set out to do. So it's just kind of like, it's interesting. It's the same thing with the actors and the filmmakers. Is like some of them you want to see them experiment a little more, and there's others where, yeah, I mean, you've earned your keep, but I'd like. Yeah, you know, so if you want to hang it up now, that's okay, but I'd rather you do a little more than this or that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think within the film music community especially, they just want to hear their favorite composers do the exact same thing over and over again, when in reality these composers don't want to do that. They're like, okay, look, I've already done that a million times, now I want to do something different. And it's one of the reasons why composers will ask their agents. Jerry Goldsmith did it. He's like, I don't want to do action movies anymore. Give me something that's a drama. Give me a comedy. Give me give me something that's other than Total Recall. And so Don Davis, I think, was always looking to do something different. I mean, especially the music that he was composing, and from his inspiration of, first he fell in love with surrealism, which is just crazy avant-garde material, then moving on to more
perfect kind of material. Yeah.
It's really wacky, but you can hear it, and it's perfect for film music. It really is. But then moving on to more traditional minimalism, you know, the John Adams and Stephen Reich influences are most definitely there for The Matrix, but it's also those influences they come before The Matrix. But Don Davis really made that sound his own. That's the thing. He's not just completely copying their style, their sound. He's bringing that into the film music world, but also making his own and doing different things and combining different sounds and elements and whatnot. And, throughout the early 2000s, I mean, there wasn't a lot of room for diversity for Don Davis, but I think he did what he could, especially with some of the budgets that he had. And I mean, one thing he rarely wrote was a pure dramatic score. I think the closest was The Unsaid. A lot of it was
TV movies, but that's like about
action,
it.
Big, whatever. And I mean, who knows if that was a reason why he might have wanted to step away and do something on his own, which was his opera, because it was just a barrage of action thriller films. And that can be daunting. That could be quite daunting, especially when you want to do something different. I mean, I remember reading that Al Silvestri on the film Shattered was happy that he was able to, you know, just do away with the full traditional orchestra and just work with, some strings and a small percussion section and some electronics and do that. And that, again, going back to that point, that's what excites composers. I mean, again, you're a film composer. You're going to do what the director says that they want from you. That's your job. You don't have a lot of creative freedom. But if you are able to get a movie that might be so far away from what you're used to doing, what everybody else is used to doing, some people might not like that. But the composers love that sort of stuff because, again, they get to try something new.
Oh, totally. They need something new. The Hollywood Reporter article that dissected, 20 years later, noted how Davis even worked heavily with the editor more than the Wachowski siblings.
We'll return after these messages.
Hello and welcome to Culture Shocked, the pop culture podcast brought to you by four aging millennials and our outdated opinions. Join us every Tuesday as we discuss movies, TV, games, and even music, new and old.
Dude, what do you think you're doing?
Are you seriously trying to record a promo without us right now?
Well, yeah.
Dude, you can't just do the promo by yourself. Who's gonna listen to that?
Yeah, and you probably haven't even told them that we're a pop culture podcast where we always agree on everything. For instance, the Sam Raimi trilogy easily being the best of the Spider-Man movies.
No. But I think we can all agree that Jaws is a classical masterpiece.
Nope, don't like that. But we do all agree that the sequel trilogy of Star Wars is the best in the Skywalker saga, right, guys?
That comment is so ridiculous. I don't even know where to
Anyways, that'll do it from all of us here at Culture Shock. Thanks for listening.
Do you ever find yourself thinking about who would win in a fight between Goku and Superman? Hi, I'm James Gavsy, and on the Who Would Win show, me and my co-host Ray ignore anything important happening in the outside world and debate fictional battles between characters from comics, movies, and video games.
We got a new show every week, and almost always am I the winner.
Yeah, not true, Ray.
In the past, we've discussed such matches as Captain America versus Darth Vader, Solid Snake versus the Iron Giant, classic matchups like RoboCop versus Terminator, and even the Muppets versus Sesame Street.
That one was crazy. So if you're a fan of geek culture and love a spirited debate, check out the Who Would Win Show wherever you get your podcasts, or check us out at whowouldwinshow.com.
We let things pile up in the DVR, we add them to our queues, we wait for the DVDs and Blu-rays. We time shift. The Time Shifters Podcast. Sci-fi, horror, fantasy, superheroes, comedy, action, film, television, maybe some not-so-current events. Find us on iTunes or at timeshifterspodcast.com.
Cool thing about Blind Knowledge is we are in multiple countries. We are worldwide, all across the globe. We are in the US, we are in the UK, we are in Canada, Germany, India, Japan, we're in Australia, y'all. BlindKnowledge.com. Now back to the feature presentation.
Dragon Ball Z, One Piece, Naruto, all things that we love, all manga that were originally published in the legendary magazine Weekly Shonen Jump.
But not every series can run for 300 chapters and have a hit anime. This is David.
This is Jordan.
We're the hosts of Shonen Flop. Each episode, we look at manga that ran in Jump that didn't quite make it.
We discuss what it did wrong, what it did right, how the series could have turned itself around, and ultimately, was it a flop or not?
Run all your favorite podcast apps, and you can find us at shonenflop.com.
Keep on flopping, floppers.
Yeah.
Makes a huge note. I'm sure you saw this same article. It talks about his lush string work, his piano, percussion, amplified flying waterphone, as well as French horns. But yeah, like you noted even earlier in just the major score as a whole, like it just makes you pay especially like explicit attention to all the horns. And
yes,
I've heard of those scores so many times, especially because I would play the various video games. I loved that whole world. I loved cyberpunk, you know, dystopian sci-fi and apocalyptic stuff involving cyborgs, martial arts, and computer hacking. So that was everything I wanted. But when you actually listen to the score, you know, 1 minute it's the Star Wars, you know, Chosen One type themes, and then you get a whole bunch of other stuff that half the time, when you're listening to the scores, you're almost expecting to hear, you know, a full just, you know, punch or rain shattering or just something else. Just one of the sound effects that, you know, just be snuck in. But I will say, I also prefer, if you're going to listen to the score for the original movie, don't buy the first edition because it's not even the complete score. Like you gotta get the full like special edition, I think, CD-ROM.
I know that there was a
I think
there was an isolated score track on the DVD.
That might have been it too. But
yeah. So Verez Saraband Records, I mean, thank God, without them, we would not have heard a note from this score.
A dozen different movies, yeah.
Yeah, the 30 minute album that they released, and that's all they could release because it's so expensive to release music scored by union players, but they managed to get 30 minutes out. And I mean, all that was out, I think, when the film came out was just the song track with all the songs and whatnot. And there was no Don Davis material. So Verez Saraband got the 30 minutes out, and that's all we had for the longest time. And then they released a deluxe edition many years ago, which still wasn't complete. And I think it was only a couple years ago that Verez finally did a complete rendition of the Matrix, the original Matrix. And
but the reloaded score, I will applaud them for deciding, hey, we're going to take the iconic scores and then mix it with the various songs that play throughout the movies and then ones that are made exclusively for the soundtrack. And I was just like, that was a good marketing decision, whoever made that call.
That reloaded album I played on repeat when I got it for the very first time. I listened to all the songs, and I don't normally listen to, like, I'm not a huge fan of like songs in movies or like needle drop songs, But they were all great. And then the entire, all the score selections.
You can like
were
it
fantastic.
Even if you don't like the movie. That's how bold
yeah,
it is.
It was wonderful. And and Revolutions was an entire score album. But Reloaded
actor
was
guys. Yeah.
Wow. Reloaded was magnificent. And again, the Mona Lisa Overdrive, when we finally got to hear the original Burly Brawl with the deluxe edition soundtrack that came out, I could not believe that was dropped. Just the sheer amount of it's probably one of the most insane action tracks I've heard. It's 6 minutes of just
it almost feels
the trumpets
like
must have had their lips must have been bleeding. It was just the it was like 16th notes, 32nd notes, and it was just a frenzy of brass. It was all timed perfectly. If you see, there's a wonderful YouTube video that shows the isolated score of what the Burly Brawl would have been like with the unused cue. And the amount, I find it just amazing that they can, from like the microsecond, hit a certain beat, like whether it's a punch or an impact or whatever, and especially in an absolutely chaotic piece of music like the original Burly Brawl, and the fact that was tossed, I'm sure that sheet of score was all black. Just all black note. It was unbelievable. I mean, I like what's there. It's energetic. Like even the original Chateau sequence has a more, I think the track's called Chateau Swashbuckling.
Yeah.
And that one, again, he's hitting incredible sync points with his music. And I don't mind what was done after the fact, but that stuff kind of plays through the scene where Don Davis is actually interacting with the scene with his unused cue, and I really mm-hmm. appreciate that. But then again,
much like the Star Wars scores, you don't really notice how much isn't in the scene until you've heard them a dozen different times, and you're like,
right,
wait a sec,
right,
in the movie this cuts to here but is reused in this such and such sequel. And here, yeah, with Matrix, we got to actually examine it a little more closely.
Well, that's the thing you're talking about. You're right. Talking about examining the Matrix. I mean, I think that these three scores are just as important as Lord of the Rings scores, which won a plethora of Oscars, is hailed as like one of the greatest things ever done, which is true. I mean, they're fantastic scores. They have books written about them. There's deluxe edition soundtracks. Everybody knows Howard Shore's material, but Don Davis's music, I think, is just as important, especially with the development of themes, which mm-hmm. is something that is key to the Lord of the Rings. But he saves the full development of certain themes until the last movie. Like there's hints of the love theme between Trinity and Neo, but it doesn't come to full fruition until Matrix Revolutions. And the development of that is fascinating. The development of the other themes, the development of the sounds. I mean, someone's got to write a book on it. I can't do it because I'm a terrible writer, but somebody out there who knows how to do this, I would pay good money to read the analysis of the music from The Matrix. It's just as important. And I would love to see it live, played by a live orchestra one of these days. I know they've done a couple of concerts with The Matrix, but if they
I didn't think of it that way, but that is very true. That
it would be, that poor orchestra.
Oh, yeah.
For 2 hours straight playing that stuff, but man, I would love to see that performed live.
Yeah, but I didn't think of that. But yeah, if you examine it very clearly, yeah, they don't go into the main deep dramatic emotions until the third movie.
Yeah. I mean, and that's the whole point of the big Neo-Dameron fight sequence. I mean, it's all, he's like, I'm going to just throw it all at you. And it's just the biggest orchestrations, the biggest choir he could find. And he lays it all out there. It's a religious experience for him. And it's pretty much a religious experience within the movie as well. And it's just this final battle between good and evil. It's like listening to, let's say, Return of the King, where it's all out there. You know, it's just fantastic stuff. It's a score that needs to, it's a series of scores that I think are underappreciated. They don't get enough.
It's more than
love.
Just worried about giving you chills and emotion. It's also all about showing the pivotal moments and energy rush and inertia rushing through everyone's mind. That's, I think, why those scores stand out so much, because yes, yeah, you know, we do have the audience's journey, and we do have the characters just very well realized. But yeah, when we see them actually kind of still making use of an orchestra, it's just like you say, it's a proper, you know that the homework is perfectly displayed on screen, in addition to just going up and beyond. I do like the contrast to Howard Shore, because yeah, Lord of the Rings, same kind of just love letter of just a three part an opera, in
yes,
this case fantasy. And I still gotta applaud Davis, because while he kind of did get typecast, even for some of the same movies that around that same time were like, hey, we want what's in the Matrix, we want you to provide that as well with your score, and yet still feeling inspired to have his own kind of score and tone in each movie he does, without just falling into said typecast of, well, I guess the boss said it better be like the Matrix. It's like, I could still do my own thing.
Yeah, and it's a tough thing for composers to work around. I think I remember reading an article where Davis was mentioning, after the Matrix and any project that he was on, they were temping the films with his music from the Matrix. And, you know, even Bruce Broughton brought this up, where I think he was working on Tombstone, and they temped it with his music from Silverado. And he's like, hey, the temp that you guys did, I mean, the music is fantastic, but it is all wrong for this movie. And that's the problem with Don Davis and the Matrix, is that any other movie that he was working on, they're like, oh, look, isn't this great? We used your music from the Matrix in this sequence and this sequence. And he's like, the music's fantastic, but the Matrix doesn't fit, let's say, Jurassic Park 3 or Behind Enemy Lines, or, or, you know, it'll fit the Matrix. Like, you're hiring me. Sure. Okay. You might've heard the Matrix, but now let's do something else. I mean, you know what I'm capable of doing, but I'm not going to do Matrix 4 or 5 for your film that isn't the Matrix. And that's the hard part. You're right. Not getting pigeonholed, typecast. A lot of composers go through that. And I mean, you mentioned Hans Zimmer, he's trying as much as he can throughout his career to evolve his style, try something new. While some scores might sound very similar, there's a point now where he's one that can get away with it, because he's just like the A-list of A-list composers. And so when he's attached to a film, it's like, all right, so what are we going to do, and what's this new thing that we're going to do, and how are we going to do it so it doesn't sound like anything else? And so you hear stuff like, you know, you hear Inception, you hear Interstellar, you hear Dune, and it's like you've never heard that stuff before until then. And I mean, that's a hard thing to do when, even though you worked on the Matrix, as you know, Don Davis still wasn't that A-list composer. I don't think he had the power of somebody like John Williams or Hans Zimmer to say, you know, I'm going to now go off and do something smaller. I'm going to do this, or I'm going to do that. And that's a hard thing for him that's a hard thing for any composer to get away with, again, because you are at the mercy of the director, and hopefully you are in, you have a good collaboration with your director, and you can present ideas, but ultimately, so whatever the director wants, you gotta do it, or somebody else will,
even if it's totally wrong.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. I mean, there was a track listing I saw the other day, and it literally says, you know, this is the track that the director made me write at the last minute, or something like that. It was literally the track name, and it was like, obviously that was like a last second thing, they wanted to throw it out, and he had to do something that probably wasn't what he wanted to do.
Yeah.
And I mean, that happens. Rejected scores happen. Cues get thrown out all the time. You know, Jerry Goldsmith had the hardest time working with Ridley Scott. He would come up with ideas, and it's like, nope, we don't like that. Do something else. Right. Yeah. So you're again, as a film composer, you really can't do your art. I mean, you can be artistic, but you
pretty much the rest of it is studios or the filmmakers saying,
and that's it. There's so many fingers in the pie, and
even directors don't have control.
That's true. Even
writers,
very true.
They have probably the worst end, because at the end of the day, people can surgically remove their script with 10 different people who are uncredited, and at the end of the day, they get the blunt of the forced trauma, so to speak, because people see their name and they go, you wrote this great movie. Oh, I didn't have anything to do with it. You wrote this awful, you know, poorly worded movie. Well, I didn't have anything to do with that either. Sorry. You know, it's just,
yeah,
you like you say, you pretty much have to brace for impact. You never know if it's going to go well, or it might be the job that gets you your next five jobs that you.
And that's very true. That's very true. You know, do the work. And I mean, there's so much more to it than just composing. You know, it's who you know, much like Don Davis here, you know, yeah. Happened to
but I think get you introduced answered to your Joe question. Harnell. I think he is kind of a hired gun at this point. And if he's getting more reward out of the opera, I guess he just, I don't want to really, I really do not want to speculate, but I would not be surprised if he just, like many people who, you know, were big in the 90s and 2000s and then kind of silently left after a while, is like he might have just said, you know, I'm good.
I know. Yeah. I mean, I'll it's also up. A style of score that's it's not really in style anymore. And
yeah,
you know, the one, I mean, if he wanted to write music of this sort, he could probably, you know, go out to Japan or go to Spain where they still love this sort of stuff. And I mean, it's probably one of the reasons why he worked on the Tokyo Ghoul. But yeah, it's, I think his time has come and gone, which is sad, but he's left, quite a legacy.
Oh, and there's totally even episodes of TV that people should totally rip, that Star Trek Next Gen episode, which is the one where Troy's undercover as a, Romulan, has some really, really suspenseful, tones. I don't know if it's on any of the, CD scores, maybe it is. I think
it is. Yeah, La La Land.
Okay,
yeah, La La Land did a complete set of Next Generation.
Okay, so
I think they did Next Generation. I think they did all Deep Space Nine, everything from Voyager. It's out there now. Yeah,
but like you say, he is one of those. He should totally make like the top 20 or even 100 composers. But
I think he's important. Absolutely. I mean, for what he did in 1999, as much as that score didn't really change the sound of film music, much like some of the other more influential film composers throughout the history of cinema, it's still an important milestone, much like the movie itself. And I think that, as I said, those three scores should be studied. People should pay attention to them. If you're a composer and you really want to know how to do something fresh but also keep it within that traditional sound and but also, you know, employ modern techniques or modern music or whatever, this is the score that you go for.
A very bold, very inviting, very I keep going back to your earlier points because those were just some very well stated material, but I'm glad you brought up the Bound score, because I think, you know, so I saw that, you know, when I wanted to go back and see what the Wachowskis had done earlier. And
yeah,
much like Mark Mancina, I am very just blown away by how, you know, in Mancina's case, he was just working on a lot of made for TV, as well, just obscure independent B movies, as well as pretty much being mentored by Hans Zimmer. In Davis's case, he pretty much, he was going for the same kind of level of having a bunch of tension, morbid thrills, and deceit that accompanied a lot of the mystery stuff he was doing. And that was in between all his other TV miniseries and TV movies that were often, you know, Fox or UPN or CBS movies of the week. But it's just mind-blowing how you can give that major kind of a feel on a small screen and then do just a good job on theatrical material as well, because it doesn't work for everybody. There's some people who I don't want to deny their talent. I'm not sure what they would sound like outside of TV. Maybe it might work for a movie, or maybe it might not. I don't know until I see what they can do.
Television has definitely evolved. I mean, there's the lines have been really blurred since kind of streaming or
they're not making any money, unfortunately.
Like they're huge, like movies now. I mean, you look at Game of Thrones, it's like a 10 episodes a season is a 10 hour film. I mean, and even the Rings of Power, you just listen to what Bear McCreary did for that one. That I think is one of the most incredible pieces of work in the 21st century for any type of media composing. It's an incredible achievement. And so those lines are kind of blurred now, but before, I mean, Don Davis, I think, even mentioned that when he was working on Beauty and the Beast, it was really one of those last fully orchestral television scores that they were working on. I mean, I can't imagine how much money it was costing each and every episode for them to keep that quality up. But, you know, Lee Holdridge led the charge by writing the theme, writing the scores, and then bringing Don Davis on to write the other scores. And some television movies were getting, you know, large scale score, like The Beast. He did The Beast, and that's a huge symphonic score. Mists of Avalon by Lee Holdridge, a big orchestral score. You know, some of these miniseries would start getting big orchestral scores, but as for television, the orchestral score, I mean, it was dead, and then Giacchino comes around and does Lost and just changes everything. And now with television, like I said, the lines have been blurred between television and motion pictures. I mean, the budgets are the same. The quality of the writing is might even better on TV than it is in cinema. But they're big budget films that we just so happen to watch on our 55-inch screens at home.
True,
that's where I would love to see it. Maybe Don Davis can get into television. Who knows? That'd be fantastic. But the quality is definitely, I mean, I would say that we're in like a golden age of television music right now. It's the incredible quality that we're getting. I mean, the Orville, for crying out loud, I can't imagine how expensive the music is for that. And they got four dynamite composers, including like John Debney and Joel McNeely, established composers. Kevin Casca just started working on season 3, and he's an incredible composer. Andrew Cotty is great as well. I mean, just what a wonderful team of composers. But yeah, you wouldn't hear a score like that on a television series. I mean, crying out loud, you wouldn't even hear that in Star Trek The Next Generation.
No.
Because that became wallpapered music.
Although I gotta applaud Jeff Russo, who's scoring all of the five TV shows.
And Russo's been removed from Picard, so I think it's Stephen Barton's working on that now. Barton, the showrunners changed. Female
composer, and all of them find their own vibe, their own feel, which is exactly what you need, because all those shows need to have their own identity.
For sure. Yes. And so, yeah, television scoring is pretty, it's pretty amazing.
Goranson,
now.
I've heard, I think, all the tunes he did for The Mandalorian will be stuck in your. Most people might remember just the in jingle, but there's plenty of other
memorable
ones that, it's just adorable. But it's like there's so many other ones where you'll be like, how did that even get birth? How did that even get,
Well, that's it. It's amazing how fast a film composer has to be inspired. They have such a little time to write this music.
You got to do more than just wait for the check to clear. You got to actually say, I got it in me. I know exactly what I want with this. Yep.
Absolutely. It's hard. I don't envy these guys, especially if you got multiple films in a year, Marconi was writing 10 or more a year sometimes. I know James Horner did like 10 in a year. I mean, John Williams was writing,
different,
I think it was like 2005, he did four of them, or 2004, he did four movies. It was like, man, I and they were all different too. That's the crazy thing.
Yeah.
Just the sheer amount of work that these guys can put together, and the artistry, the inspiration that they can find just like that. It's pretty amazing. These guys are pretty amazing.
1,000%. Has Davis, since he's doing orchestras, is he constantly travel for up here, like in giant places like California, Vegas, Dallas, or even Atlanta?
Yeah, I'm not sure what he is doing. We don't hear much about his career.
I kept looking around, and it seemed like he might have back in the day done some music score like concerts, but
yeah, he did. He did a Matrix Symphony for a film music festival, when that was released through Movie Score Media, and it's a really great album. So he condensed those scores into suites, or like movements for a symphony. And I think he also did a Warriors of Virtue suite as well for that concert, which is pretty wild. And I know that he did, I mean, one of the very first live to picture concerts. So he did the Matrix. And
picture is so empowering. I prefer those slideshows way more over just random movie clips.
Yeah. And I mean, but what's so great about like those live concerts where you get to see the whole entire movie is that you're going to hear pieces that would probably never, ever be performed in public again, if ever. And so it's always fascinating to get to see, hear the whole thing live, even though like the dialogue sometimes drowns out the orchestra. But but yeah, I would love to. I mean, if they did a Matrix trilogy, you know, live to the screen, I would be first in line. I think those concerts are great and a great way to introduce anybody to the symphony orchestra. But then that also, you know, that can also get you into classical music at the same time as well. So I think they're pretty important.
Totally. And much like some of these other TV composers, like we brought up Ludwig, but even Sean Callery, I think all these guys, the late W.G. Snuffy Walden also, I think Walden was wild because he was used to kind of doing things by himself, and he had to teach himself piano just for the West Wing score. And I think a lot of that same kind of deal here is just with these guys. They had their own device that they were so reliable for that time that they were constantly working. And now they're still just kind of just surprising us because we're just like, whoa. But you really do deserve your accolades and additional material, because you're really, like you say, you're going beyond the tune, no pun intended. You're going beyond even any of the homework. You legit want to make sure that this score will be its own character, much like all the living and breathing people we see on screen.
Yeah, and that's a tough thing to do. It's when we go back to, you know, what the director wants, and sometimes they just want you to create an atmosphere, do something simple, don't do anything crazy, don't get noticed, support the movie. But you know, there are directors out there that are absolutely against leitmotivic scores, big scores that will tell you how to feel. Which I find is absolutely bonkers, especially in the medium of film, which is a medium that is put together to manipulate your emotions. And so that's what music is there for. Music really does help tell the story and tell you things that actually aren't there, but that are part of the character and might come to play later in the movie. But it's you know, as much as a composer has an idea for what they might want to do in a film, you know, sometimes they're just they're just stuck. They're stuck. They just gotta do what the director wants. And sometimes it's just the simplest things, and that's what's gonna work for them. I prefer more expressive scores that are far more emotional.
Expressions are definitely underrated.
Yeah, that tell the story, right? That really help tell the story, that really enhance those visuals. I mean, that's why I go to the movies.
Instead of a score that feels like it was added in way after the fact with no supervision.
Yeah, like anything that just kind of feels like it's just kind of floating on the surface and not really commenting on the drama or having anything to say, but it's just kind of there. It's like, well, what really is the point of that? How is it impacting the storytelling? And that's what I like about Michael Giacchino. Michael Giacchino is a storyteller first and foremost. You know, he made movies when he was a kid, and he understands what movie making is all about, and now he's getting into directing. But he understands that when he comes onto a project, he's like, story is key. And so how is my music going to help impact that story? And how is it going to help it work emotionally? And sometimes he's like, maybe we don't need music here. Or maybe the piece of music that I wrote for this sequence is too much. Let's strip that all away and let's go and do it again. And that's what he did for the balloon sequence in Up. The original cue was just too much. And so he said, forget it. We're going to chat. We're going to toss it. And I'm going to do something else. And the something else was way better than the original. But the original is fascinating as well. But, you know, but that's the kind of trust you have in yourself. You have, and the director might have in you. Again, it's really
pretty much why they're letting him direct, because he can be trusted with any implement of story, whether it's doing the storyboards versus the, I mean, as you've already summed up, you know, he invests himself with people who care about every single part. It's not just blindly going in. I think I want to do a good job.
Right. Yeah. So, and you know, a guy like Giacchino is able to, you know, pick and choose who he wants to work with now. But I mean, he just, I mean, he'll tell you that he lucked into to some of the things that he got to do. And I mean, but that's not because he didn't work hard. It's just people noticed his stuff, and it just so happened there's a chance that J.J. Abrams was playing Medal of Honor, and he's like, hey, I'm going to do a TV show called Alias.
And that was actually where I first heard his scores was for a lot of so it's, military
it's games. It's amazing how those stories happen and how chance encounters can lead you to another aspect of your career. And the same thing happened here with Don Davis. You know, Davis was introduced to Joe Harnell, who was working on V and working on The Incredible Hulk, who then introduced him to Mark Snow. We all know who Mark Snow is.
I love that.
And then, you know, it was Talee Holdridge. And then there was Randy Newman, I think, that helped secure his job on The Matrix.
Yeah.
Even though that the Wachowskis wanted to work with him again after the success of Bound, it was Randy Newman that was like, no, he's worked, Don Davis has worked with me before, and he's going to do a fantastic job with The Matrix, and you should use him and keep him. And because it's a high profile film, it's like, oh, Don Davis. So it's like, yeah, if you can get that type of support, but if you can sort of almost luck into those jobs and you know, it's who you know, and you might be in the right place at the right time, that's part of the business.
It really is. And sometimes you really do have to read the riot act just to remind people, hey, please don't mess with this. This is fine.
Yeah, I mean, and composers have fought for their music, and sometimes they win. You know, Bernard Herrmann. Famously, writing music for the shower sequence in Psycho when Alfred Hitchcock Herrmann, said no. It worked. You know, the instinct paid off. Although then, you know, a couple years later it didn't, and you know, their relationship ended because Bernard Herrmann just kind of went way too far. But so, like I said, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And
in all fairness, sometimes you got to take a chance all the time. So they weren't going to get along anyway, eventually. Right. So.
Yeah. Those two huge egos.
Their failure to be,
I'm surprised
that they
were able to work on so many movies that their relationship didn't die earlier than that. So
I am surprised at how many people lasted as long as they did. It does rival like how many of these TV show co-stars who, you know, were on a show together for like a decade and hated each other's guts. And you're right. Like, how on earth did they do that, you know, without making it so blatantly obvious that they're not in the same room?
Yeah.
Some people can do that. They can be pros. And then there's others just like, just give it up. It's just blatantly on your face that you just don't want to be here right now.
Yeah, indeed.
But yeah, no, I feel like you have summed up for the majority of this hour. Just I don't see how else we could describe Mr. Davis. He's dynamite, and at the same time kind of a genie in a bottle, and so many other just invaluable things. He's just,
yeah, I mean, he's a guy who really worked hard to get to where he ended
you
up.
You feel it.
Yeah.
Unlike some of these others, like, I'm not really 100% on Junkie XL right yet. I'm just kind of like, okay, I see what he's trying to do, but he's kind of more of a commercial composer versus someone who I want for a dramatic piece or a sci-fi piece or a terrifying horror piece or an exciting action piece, you know?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's there's so many different tastes out there, and that's another hard thing that some people have a difficult time wrapping their brains around, that, you know, there's people who love, let's say, Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, who I personally am not a huge fan of in the film score world, but, you know, they love some that stuff, and they don't love orchestral music. You know, but I'm a huge traditionalist, and I love hearing big orchestral scores, and I think that's great. But, you know, but there are, you know, people have different tastes, and that's what's so great about film music. Film music has so many different genres to choose from, and that's why I love listening to it. If I want to listen to jazz, I can pick up an Alex North score. If I want to listen to, you know, something more relaxing, I can go to Vangelis's Blade Runner. If I want to listen to something really lush and romantic, you know, I can go with anything written by John Williams or James Horner. And there's just so many options. And that's why I really love film music. I mean, film music isn't just a genre. I mean, there's just so many subgenres that I mean, again, Don Davis is doing something different compared to other composers. You know, if there's days that I want to hear something absolutely crazy and insane and neat and weird in the, you know, serial minimalism realm, I'll go for The Matrix, you know. But if I want something that's a little bit more traditional, then yeah, Star Wars. So with Don Davis, I mean, it's great to see his career and the overview of his career and how hard he worked. And not only was he a composer, he's a musician and loves writing his own stuff.
Someone who you can really just get behind instead of, well, I guess I'll follow the leader, even though I don't get their gist. You know?
Right. He worked. I mean, he could have easily just stayed as an orchestrator. And I know that's not what he wanted to do, but I mean, that was, it was paying off. He was working with a lot of great people, but then eventually it was going to work that he was going to get into composing his own stuff. So it takes time to really hone that craft.
I wonder if Bruce Berman or Joel Silver or anyone else at Warner Brothers knew him when he was just an orchestrator, because he's on a lot of those productions. And I just,
oh, it's possible. It is, it's completely possible. Yeah. I mean, and Joel Silver loved music. I mean,
he loves all kinds of movies. That's the funny thing. People like to compare him to his rival Jerry Bruckheimer, but here's the deal: Bruckheimer just kind of likes stuff that's cool, that goes boom. Silver likes all kinds of things, but he mainly just will hire people, especially cinematographers, who have a noir kind of look.
Mm-hmm.
And like you say, he does love symphonies, because I think he would always go to the opera in between yelling at people at pitch meetings. he wanted to buy sculptures and go see the orchestra with his friends and family.
But he knew his film music. I mean, he made sure that guys like Michael Kamen and Alan Silvestri were on these projects, and Christopher Young, for crying out loud, got a lot of great jobs because of, you know, working under Joel Silver. So a lot of these guys got a lot of great gigs because of him. But he was a real supporter of really good film music, and
he wanted everyone to be happy with what they had to show.
Yeah,
and that's the thing. Like, he was kind of like everyone's favorite, or least favorite, if you want to go there, grumpy uncle, who is like, I'm not yelling at you, but I am raising my voice. I'm telling you right now, I want this. I want you to be happy with this and own it. And I want this, because then I get my money back, and I'm proud of this fucking movie too. And so it's just so wild when you have that amount of just passionate people under a roof. And now that I don't feel like there's going to ever be any of that amount of in Hollywood, especially not now, but it's kind of getting even ridiculous too, how there's some people getting canceled, and yet there's some of these other bad apples who are totally infamous, who, you know, talent or not, are still working and yet pissing a lot of people off. So it is interesting how it kind of comes and goes, how people eventually, you know, stop being invited back because they're just characters behind the scene. But then there's others who, Davis is one of those where I too am just like gasping at straws. I'm like, other than liking the orchestra, why'd you stop, dude? You need to come back. I will support it. I will buy the movie score before it even comes out. At least Score TV. Shit.
Absolutely. I'm with you 100%.
Do an HBO Max.
Yes.
Docudrama. Do a Showtime miniseries. Do something that's a Band of Brothers level kind of score that you.
Oh my God. Yes. Yes. And it would be celebrated. That's for sure.
So be celebrated.
Yep.
Oh, well, thank you once again, Eric, for just joining in all the fun here.
My pleasure.
What episodes would you like to promote? That
I'm not sure when this is coming out.
I don't know yet either. Sorry.
Okay. Well, look, you know what? One of the best things I've ever done. I did it last year. It was the 6-part John Williams series that I did. That was a redo of the show I did 10 years ago, and I really wanted to make sure I did it right. And that
whatever you got to really revisit out of. If you can talk about it at length, it's already a good show. It's just then a matter of then. Yes. It's like, how much extra work do you want to apply for yourself? There's so many solo episodes I've done at this damn podcast, and I've said, you know what? It can wait. I already know what I'm going to say and how I'm going to say it. But do I want to record it now under these circumstances? Probably not. So it's just interesting how we all decide how to make less, you know, time and efforts for ourselves. And at the same time, we still have to make sure it's like, okay, if I'm tuning out, someone else probably is too. And you know what? What
well, right. Polish? Exactly. Exactly. And there are other shows that I've been working on. I'm redoing my James Bond show, which was arguably, from the stats, was like one of the most popular shows I've ever done. And that's when Skyfall first came out. And my site exploded when I premiered the score on the show. I want to do that right. I really want to get there's still some things that I didn't address, and I want to bring it up to date. And so that's something I'm working on. And I'm working on kind of rejigging a few of the other shows. But there's always so much going on. I mean, I'm going to be exploring John Williams's classical material in the next few months. And so that's just a lot of work as well. But it's still fun, and there's still a lot to do. And it's always exciting anytime I get a chance to work on it whenever I can. So
nice. Keep knocking it out of the park, and hell, introduce other people to the other stuff Thomas Newman has worked on.
Yeah, that's a show I eventually got to do a Thomas Newman show for sure. Yeah, I love his stuff.
100%. And this is fun too, because half the time we'll look at someone's scores and be like, hey, I like their work. The score didn't do it for me. Or it sounds different than it does in the movie. Why the hell is that? Did an editor tinker with it? What was going on?
Yeah, that's fascinating as well. Incredibly fascinating.
Even some of the, sometimes you'll actually see people who have all this extra time on their hands, and they'll go to YouTube saying this is different, or this is a version of the score that's only in this rare TV spot or trailer for it. Mm-hmm. Like, what? Mm-hmm. Oh my God, you're right.
yeah, exactly. There's so much to, I mean, especially with there's so many expanded complete form soundtracks that have come out now that are showcasing so many things that I didn't even know. Like when the Back to the Future score finally came out, I didn't realize there was an earlier score written that was essentially kind of tossed, right? Spielberg's like, I don't like it, do better. And you can hear the evolution of that score through this 2-CD set, which I was like, I had no idea. I had no idea an entire score was written.
Listening to even rejected scores.
And it's a classic.
There's that, as well as the rejected scores Randy Newman's done, which are interesting as well. You're like, I can see why his scores just twice. I know that has to hurt for Wolfgang Petersen's, Troy and Air Force One. They just don't work. But there's still interesting scores on
I got an entire book through over there called Torn Music. And all they do is they talk about all the rejected scores in the history of cinema. It's about this thick. And the stories are incredible.
Nice.
Like James Horner coming in on Ransom and he had about 7 days to write and record it. That's crazy. I think he had 14 days to redo Troy after Gabriel Yard wrote that masterpiece. It's unreal how fast these guys can work and get stuff out. And like I said, we were talking about inspiration. It's like, then you don't even have time to think. It's just like first thing comes out, put it on paper, record it, and go. It's crazy. It's crazy. But that book is amazing. If you're interested in film music and the inside workings of it and why, you know, like, wait, hold on a minute. Randy Newman wrote a score for Air Force One. That's crazy. What happened? All the stories are in that book. It's wonderful.
Well, and I'm sure it's also just, you're definitely going to have to show me that link. I will check the, I will read the shit out of that book. But
yeah, it's great. It is really good. Really detailed. A lot of stuff that I didn't even know. It's great. It's a great read.
Do you ever feel like even some of it, like that goes into their own urgency for the score itself, just because that's what they're feeling right now? Gotta get this done.
Like you can, it's funny because some of the best music was like last second stuff. You listen to Jerry Goldsmith's Chinatown. That was a last second score that he wrote in 2.5 weeks. And it's a classic score. And it's like, okay. And other times I'm just so amazed that they were able to take such a little amount of time. And like, for instance, Giacchino on Rogue One had 4.5 weeks to write that score. And it was like Doctor Strange has just finished. He wanted to go on vacation, couldn't go on vacation. And he had to start immediately writing music for that. And he wrote a plethora of themes and complete suites and 2 hours of music all in 4.5 weeks. So I'm like, what in the world? But he said, you know, it was like the first idea that comes out, I'm writing it. And it's just like flowing out of him. And he couldn't second guess himself. And that's what I find interesting, is that those last second scores are like, it's so organic. It's just first idea. I can't question what I'm writing or reading. It's like, I can't toss it. It's like, I got to go with the flow and here you go. Send it off to the copyist. And we've got to record in a couple of weeks. It's fascinating that they're able to do that. And that's why they're pros. They're just so they're unbelievable. Film composers are unbelievable, especially with the sheer amount of pressure that they have, because they're like really one of the last people to touch the movie and to really affect it besides the sound team. I mean, it's and on top of that, you are, as a composer, almost left to your own devices. And I mean, I couldn't imagine being a director going, well, here's my movie, make it better, and I hope you do. It's such a weird experience because the director is touching everything, but they, most of them, 99% of them, can't write or talk about music.
Exactly. As long as they, it's kind of the same thing that the director has with, you know, giving a promise to the screenwriter, I'm going to do the best I can to interpret, reword your dialogue. Same deal with the cinematographer. Hey, I don't tell you how to frame this, but I'm going to still, or I'm not going to tell these actors how to act, but here's what I'm looking for, versus telling you how to do your job. And as long as anyone does that, you know, and doesn't instantly doubt someone, then it won't be the equivalent of, hey, we were off to an okay start and now we're working with all the substitute teachers who were never going to be accepted on day one. You know,
that's a great analogy. It's exactly perfect.
I get nervous even when I hear people do it in a college, because even though supposedly everyone's an adult, there's still plenty of people who stick around.
Oh yeah,
even in a higher place. So when I hear about all these people who are talented and who hate each other's guts, it's like I can't imagine. But oh well, I'm gonna do some digging. Well, they're talented, but they're an asshole to work with. Or
that's right,
they're great to work with, but they're very opinionated, so that turns a few people off. And makes them say, talk. I mean, my manager at my job kind of does this, where he talks to someone who then talks to the other person. I'm like, you do know that's the oldest trick in the book. And that's why you got an incoherent answer, because it went from five different people. Mm-hmm. Why not just fucking ask them?
That's right. Yeah.
Throw some stones. I know you don't like to talk to this person. Guess what? You got to talk to them. It's going to have to happen.
Yep.
If you want the truth.
Yeah.
and then go with all these second opinions and what these other people are saying.
Yeah, I hear you.
Well, this is a delight. I look forward to seeing your redux of Williams and Newman, all these other guys, and there's so many other good shows on the network. So how did this network get built, if you don't mind me asking? Because I love it when I see this, when someone's got a Podbean or Spotify or Anchor account and they got like five different shows on that same network and they applaud each other for being part of said family. And it is just so unreal. It's only reminding everybody why we're still falling in love again with audio dramas and old school radio. And even people are joining their colleges and getting creative in their broadcasting area before they even graduate college, even if that's not their ultimate career move. It's so cool to see that here and there. And it's like, see, you might work for ESPN one day, you might work for your local, you know, news station, or you might work for your college radio. But that's even more awesome because people will go out if they love your voice and how you express a story, like these various composers. So it's just so cool that people are, I mean, even during COVID, you saw so many people get creative as fuck. They just said, we're going to make do with this. We don't have to worry about memorizing our lines or being in the same room or what have you. We just got to bring something to life and reword it,
right?
Rephrase it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if concerning our show, I mean, I'm trying to make it a long story, but my intention was never to have like a network of shows. I mean, I occasionally I would ask like, hey, does anybody want to host an hour? And like, you know, you want to play whatever you want, then go ahead. And I had a couple of guest hosts come on and do shows, but Jason Drury was really the first person that came aboard, and he does a show called The Archive, where he digs into kind of older scores and plays them on the show, or he does a bunch of composer interviews now. And it's interesting to see how his career has evolved, and I'll get to that in a minute. But you know, he came on board because he lost, he was doing this James Horner special. He did an incredible three-part documentary, audio documentary to composer James Horner. I think it's one of the best things that the network has on it. And if you are a fan of James Horner, I highly recommend going to check it out, not just because it's on Cinematic Sound Radio. If it was not on Cinematic Sound, I would still recommend you listen to it. It's an incredible show, but still he got, I don't know if it was fired, but he had a bad relationship with the station manager at some online radio, station. And he was producing this show for him, but he only got part one out, and the guy refused to put part two and three out. So Jason said, forget this. You keep part one. I will redo it my way, because he recorded with the guy who he didn't like. And so he redid it completely. And then he presented part one, two, and three on my show. He said, you can have these. You have a bigger audience. So I think more people are going to get their ears on this. And I said, this is fantastic. So do you want to do anything for me? Like, do you want to do more radio shows? And he's like, absolutely. The thing about Jason, and the reason I talk about, because his evolution has been absolutely amazing. I mean, he, very shy person, you know, could have difficulties talking to people, but this really opened him up. And then he got an opportunity to talk to his heroes, the composers that he grew up listening to.
Various
and he
ones.
Thought that was absolutely amazing.
Wanted to ask 100 questions.
But now he's writing for one of the major film music digital publications called Film Score Monthly. He just made the front cover. He's the front cover story on that magazine. He interviewed the composer from Knock on the Cabin Door, or whatever that new M. Night Shyamalan movie is. And you know, his evolution to, you know, talking from smaller composers to guys who he likes, like he just interviewed Christopher Young. He interviewed Robert Folk. He's talked with Craig Safin, The Last Starfighter. You know, all these great composers, Brad Fidel, The Terminator. So the fact that, you know, I've seen him evolve, and I've seen him open up and become a new person because of Cinematic Sound Radio. And so getting the opportunity to help other smaller podcasters who might feel like that they like didn't want to do it anymore. Randy Andrews, Soundtrack Alley. I thought he had a great idea, just talking for a couple hours about one movie and one score. And he didn't want to do it anymore because he says he wasn't getting the audience. So I said, bring it over to Cinematic Sound and you'll find an audience. Same thing with Lee Bricknell at Filmic. She was at another online radio station that shut down. She tried to do it herself, was failing, wasn't getting the numbers. And she says, I'm done. I'm like, I don't want this show to die. I love this show. Will you come on to Cinematic Sound Radio and I'll give you, you know, a chance to, you know, you'll be on my RSS feed and whatever. And that's how it kind of went about, just giving chances to people who might not know how to do this sort of thing. And all they have to do is just hand the show to me and I'll take care of everything else. And so that I find it's very rewarding. I mean, God, it's a ton of work. It really is a ton of work. We have 10 unique shows, but I find that the people who we're going to have shows that we're going to die that are now reinvigorated and re-inspired to keep going. And because of Cinematic Sound Radio, I mean, I don't want to pat myself on the back, but I'm super proud of that. And I love it. And I love that people who normally would not have a podcast or a radio show now do because they're on my podcast.
Follow us on the web on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The podcast is available on Podbean, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Anchor, Apple, and anywhere else podcasts are available. Feel free to review our show and leave comments on any of those sites. Thanks a million for listening. It's a jacked up.